about and make sure she was alone. Sure she was safe, Betsy pushed her way through the bushes to haul on the dilapidated gate, seeking to get it open, her hopes fading very swiftly. It would not budge an inch, even with strenuous effort. She laid her head on the remains of what paint was yet to peel off, knowing her intention to escape was impossible to achieve. Henry had forestalled her by having the gate sealed, which told her he must have known the purpose to which it had been put before last night. Maybe as far back as the first time it had been used for her secret trysts. An image came to mind of him laughing as usual, with little in the way of humor, sarcasm being his habit. He would be saying, "My dear Elizabeth, what an obvious creature you are." It was a dispirited sister who made her way to the main carriage driveway, which ran up to the house from the road to Canterbury. She suspected Tanner, who manned the outer gate, would have been instructed to deny her exit, and Betsy did not even have to pose the question. An exchanged look told her that was the case at several yards' distance, so she wearily retraced her steps. Back at the house and divested of her cloak and outdoor shoes, Betsy went in search of her aunt, finding her in the drawing room. She made no attempt to moderate her fury or to keep it from other ears by shutting the door. Sarah Lovell tried to get past her, but Betsy physically blocked her path, spittle coming from her lips as she screamed at her, "How could you allow yourself to become complicit in this crime?" "I was not complicit. You witnessed the parish register." If the older woman had set out to be defiant, it could not last in the face of her own self-censure. The expression crumpled, and the voice turned to a plea. "What choice do I have, Elizabeth?"
"So you will just obey Henry, regardless of the dishonesty of his actions. Do you know what that makes you?"
Sarah Lovell's chin was near to her chest, and her voice was low. But there was a sting in her response.
"It makes me what I have to be, for I have never been in receipt of the advantages you have enjoyed."
"Advantages?"
It was an unwise response, which Betsy knew it to be as soon as the word was uttered. She was soon given a list of those from a woman who clearly harbored and had kept hidden a whole raft of resentments. Betsy had been doted on by her father, even before the death of her mother, Sarah Lovell's sister, but no one had ever bothered to inquire whether she, bereft of a husband who had gone out one day and never returned, was happy to step into those shoes.
"How do you think everyone in this house sees me? As one of the family? No, and that extends, and always has, even to the servants. They do my bidding for fear of my nephew, not out of respect for me. And Henry is content to have his home run for him by someone who is bound to Cottington Court not by love or affection, but by the need to keep body and soul together."
"You have never intimated before that you were unhappy."
"What good would it have done if I had? What could I have said? Did it ever occur to you that I might petition to have my Samuel declared dead after all these years? For which, by the way, I would have had to plead for the funds to make the case, that I might want to seek happiness elsewhere, just like you."
Betsy's anger had abated somewhat in the face of these revelations, emotions that labelled her as being as insensitive as Henry, which was an uncomfortable thought. But she was not prepared to back down completely.
"I still cannot forgive that in which you were a participant." "Would it surprise you to know that I, too, cannot forgive myself?"
The glance over Betsy's shoulder, added to the look that accompanied it, had her spin round, to find standing in the doorway the person she had last seen lying drunk by her bed in his pool of vomit. In a flash, she was past her Aunt Sarah and by the fire, where she grabbed and began to brandish a long brass poker, her face contorted with fury.
"Don't you dare come near me!"
A sneer appeared on the slightly puffy face.
"Is that the way a new bride addresses her husband?"
"You are not my husband,"
came out with spit, and several forward paces, the poker waving menacingly.
"So you may disabuse yourself of the thought that you might enforce any rights you suppose you have. Come near me, and I will brain you."
Harry Spafford had taken a couple of backward steps, his eye on the poker. Sure, he was well out of the arc of possible harm. The sneer disappeared to be replaced by a snarl, which rendered ugly what could have been, without the excess puffy flesh, a quite becoming countenance.
"I think you may rest in peace on that score. As meat, you will be too refined for my tastes. Mind you, perhaps I should recount that in which I take pleasure. It may excite you and have you begging me to share your bed."
Betsy rushed at him, poker held high. But it was only to drive him backwards so she could slam the drawing-room door and lock it. She leant her hand against the waxed pine and dropped her head, her words near a whisper, but enough to carry to Sarah Lovell.
"You have to help me, Aunt Sarah. Without you, I have no one else."
With Vincent Flaherty gone, Brazier continued to brood through the remainder of the day, writing plans before discarding them into scrunched-up balls. Suddenly deciding he needed air, this took him, plus his escort, at a striding pace, south and over the open country towards and past Walmer Castle. It was on his way back he recalled something that required to be remedied. Instructions issued as soon as he was through the door.
"Joe, I need you to go to the Three Kings. Tell Mr. Garlick I will no longer require the room I bespoke yesterday. Take enough money to settle for the lack of occupancy last night, and for tonight if he feels dunned."
It took stiff resolve to say this without showing his dejection. The room had been booked for Betsy. Given, he suspected, even if he had hoped otherwise, she would have balked for the sake of her reputation at staying in Quebec House. That said, he had to have a care with the owner of the hotel, the place he had stayed on first arriving in Deal, and the lasting impression thus gained. A picture of Garlick came to mind, that long face with its purple imbiber's nose framed by those long side whiskers, running down from a bald dome. But it was not his appearance, unprepossessing as it was, that struck him so much as the man's quite shameless inquisitiveness.
"Garlick will seek a reason, Joe, for I've rarely met a man whose nose is so steeped in curiosity regarding the affairs of others. Ensure you give nothing away."
Chapter 6. Henry Tulkington was not a fellow for a fiery mount. Quite the reverse. So in the late afternoon, as he made his way back from his assignation with both pain and carnal pleasure, he could relax, stinging back aside. The sinking sun was shining, and with summer on the way there was warmth to be had from its glow, though that was often cut off by the overhanging trees coming to full leaf to dapple the roadway before him. Nothing more was required of his steady mare than an occasional tug on the reins to alter her direction, which gave him ample time for contemplation. Having come to the point where he had sight of the gates to Cottington Court, he had mulled over possible ways to proceed on several fronts, not least on Hawker's desire to take one of Spafford's luggers out to sea and sink it with him and his men tied up in the hold. A man to whom haste was anathema, Henry Tulkington hated to be pushed into too rapid a conclusion, as he had been over Elizabeth's inquisitiveness, allied to her intentions regarding Brazier. Yet, even in a relaxed mood, he had to acknowledge time was not on his side. Decisions required to be made on other matters in which he had been forced to act with unaccustomed rapidity. He was only too aware of the constraints on any arrangements mooted, for if the few who knew anything of his affairs reckoned him omnipotent, he knew it to be far from the case. Having inherited the contraband trade from his father, he could all too easily recall the admonishments from his sire on how it should be overseen. Care was as necessary as activity, and being too greedy, or too threatening to the body politic, could result in exposure and fatal retribution. A balance required to be struck between profit and the survival of the family enterprise, the latter taking primacy. Over three generations, the Tulkingtons had gone from being of no consequence to the eminence he now enjoyed, that achieved with a degree of circumspection. The ability to operate depended first of all on the endemic blind eye of the coastal community to the smuggling trade, which extended from the meanest beach hoveler to the very pillars of the community, all of whom were avid purchasers of run and untaxed goods. Ultimately, it rested on the fact that such an attitude was widespread throughout the land. Everyone who could buy goods free of duty did so, which had provided the opportunity for those who had preceded him to prosper by consolidation, gathering into their hands smaller operations to create a greater and more viable, steadily profitable whole. No longer was it necessary for a family member to put to sea, nor was he required to carry to the continent gold to purchase supplies. Monies to pay for cargoes were now transferred from the City of London by Jewish bankers. The goods bought, transported in hired and foreign registered vessels, so ownership of hull or cargo could not be traced. The landings, now overseen by Hawker, who had also inherited the role, having proved himself reliable to Henry's father, had no other connection to the son than his need to advise when and where to deploy his men. Then he did get involved, but only to ensure nothing imported was being purloined or missing, a necessary precaution. Those employed in movement were likely to be light-fingered, where no complaint regarding theft could be officially noted. Such a thing, if found, fell to John Hawker to deal with. Distribution was arranged by intermediaries. So high were the profits, it appeared as a minimal expense, and it was carried out by men unconnected to Hawker. Again, he was free of involvement, if you left out the subtle manipulation of the local magistrates and the overworked and underpaid functionary who oversaw the revenue service. Bribery was too strong a word for how Henry treated with him. Best to say, gifts were welcome to a fellow who actually did not hold the office and was poorly rewarded by the man who did. So the concerns on which Henry Tulkington ruminated were much closer to the present, and number one was Dan Spafford. He would never fit in with John Hawker, too accustomed to being the man giving the orders to take them from another. Yet disposal was dangerous, given he was so well known. Wagging tongues were not to be encouraged. Deprived of his men, he would find it near impossible to operate as a smuggler, but in order to ensure no resurgence, Henry Tulkington could demand he give up his two luggers for a sum to be paid over time. This, dissipated by the expenditure needed to keep body and soul together, would deny him the chance to fund replacements. That he would agree was scarce in doubt, once he was told what the alternative could be. His wastrel son could not be allowed to take control of Elizabeth's plantations even at a distance. Sending him or both to the West Indies had been abandoned as too risky on several counts. But Spafford was the titular person in control of the income of Elizabeth's estates on the conclusion of the marriage. Papers would have to be drawn up assigning such monies to Henry, which would at least see them properly run by a manager he would engage to take charge of the overseers already in place. Harry Spafford would be granted a stipend, which would allow him to pay for his pursuits, with added demand to stay away from his titular wife. Elizabeth presented the greatest problem, for her brother had no illusions regarding her now seeking to have the marriage annulled. It was not a subject on which he had expert knowledge, but he was as aware as any educated person would be of the grounds required to obtain such a decree: consanguinity, lunacy, or evidence of violent force. Spafford was not in any way related to the Tulkington family, though given the extent and regularities of his debaucheries, a case could perhaps be made questioning his mental abilities. Force formed the grounds on which she would seek to apply, and Elizabeth would have a case, barring one pertinent fact. To gain an annulment on such grounds, she required a witness or witnesses to swear on her behalf that the ceremony was not voluntary. Spafford would not so swear, and neither would Joshua Moyle, for fear of being deprived of his living, which had been under Tulkington family control since Henry's grandfather's day. It belonged to Cottington Court and could be taken from him in the unlikely event he had an attack of conscience. Sarah Lovell was the only one who might so swear, but Henry was sure she would not do so. She had, with great reluctance, tearfully signed the parish register. Seeing her own needs as transcending those of her niece and nothing in her station had altered, she was still utterly dependent on him and as poor as a church mouse. It would also require money to bring such a case, and Elizabeth now had none of her own. So it was a reasonably satisfied Henry Tulkington who made his front gate, to be greeted by the fellow who manned and lived in the gatehouse.
"Tried, Mr. Tulkington," Tanner said as he pulled the gate open. "As you said she would, but I reckon my look was enough to give pause."
"She will do so again, Tanner, so mark my instructions."
"Not allowed out except on your command."
"And at all times escorted, Tanner. Recall that, too."
"It would be so, Your Honour, night and day."
A nod and a kick of the heels set his mare in motion, with Tulkington thinking that was not an entirely sustainable solution. Keeping his sister a prisoner would be problematic, giving rise to questions from neighbours and friends, people she had shown an inclination to call upon. There were occasional visits to St. Leonard's Church in Upper Deal, where local society gathered. Such excursions would have to be indulged, but would also have to be carefully managed. Would it be enough? Elizabeth was a determined creature, which she had proved on the matter of marrying Brazier against his wishes. Indeed, she had been like that since childhood. As he approached the house, he was recalling, and not fondly, the way she had manipulated their father. First it had been with childish pleas, then later with feminine wiles, twisting him round her finger. This at the same time as he was in receipt of harsh parental discipline and rigid control. Time was an ally. Matters would ease once Brazier was gone, either willingly or by force. Until then, the gardeners would be required to lock away the ladders needed for their tasks, for if the estate was walled, they were not insurmountable. The head groom must ensure no horse was made available without his permission, which would allow him to assign an escort. Elizabeth could go where she wished, as long as it had his approval, and for a time yet to be determined, that did not apply to Lower Deal. Close now, he took in, as he often did, the pleasing features of his house. Its warm red brick took the sun well, and the features, which dated from the time of the Merry Monarch, in some way seemed to reflect the gaiety of his reign, especially when set against the more recent squared-off piety of the Hanoverian Georges. Cottington boasted several examples of elaborate, cross-angled brickwork, which showed the skill and design of those overseeing the laying. To break up its frontage, twin bays boasted mullioned windows, though topped with expressions of the stonemason's art, and the main door, wide and solid, gleamed with the gloss of thick layers of paint. The ornamental gates swung open to admit him to the parterre, the head gardener stopping his weeding to doff a hat at his arrival. Likewise, a lad rushed out from the stables to take his reins and hold them, leading the animal to the mounting block, where he alighted with ease. Like his sister had speculated earlier, he wondered at the level of gossip that must have greeted what had occurred, as well as how those who served him would see it. Not that it worried him unduly. Every one of them depended on him for their bed and board. They would do his bidding without comment, or face his wrath, which did not only extend to dismissal. Henry Tulkington knew himself as a man to be cautious of, if not downright respected. Any servitor sent away from Cottington Court would, once he had made plain and spread his displeasure, want for employment in the locality.
Grady, ask Mrs. Lovell to attend upon me.
Divested of his outer garments, Henry made his way to his study, where there was a good fire in the grate, making the room as warm as he liked it to be. When his aunt arrived, he noted her reaction to the heat, the pulling of a face before shutting the door, which he found annoying. Why was it that people could not comprehend how careful he had to be of his health?
Elizabeth is distraught, nephew.
She must learn to live with the consequences of her actions, not something to which she has ever been accustomed. I look to you to help persuade her that having brought this on herself, it would be best to accept the way she has carried herself up till now will no longer serve.
I'm obliged to ask, what will?
The tenor of her response did not please him, and he frowned to show it was so, but for once, Sarah Lovell felt on safe ground. Henry required an interlocutor with Elizabeth, and she was the only one who could fulfill the role. His sister would never be reconciled with what he had done, and she needed to know what plans he had, if any. As usual, Henry took defense in his sense of persecution.
I was master in my own house before you brought her back from Jamaica, but how long did it take until I was left to feel as if it was no longer so, filling the place with all and sundry and dragging me round like a prize exhibit in a marriage auction?
That had happened at the fete Elizabeth had arranged, inviting everyone she knew to a day of outdoor games, archery, bowls and the like, followed by a sumptuous evening meal in a special marquee.
She was seeking to give the estate a more cheering aspect.
It would not have been politic to add that she also believed he required a wife, and if he never entertained and rarely went to those thrown by his neighbours, such a thing was unlikely to come about.
Do I detect, in the way you say that, an agreement that such an aspect is required?
I do not see it as my place to do so.
Quite right. You may tell Elizabeth that she need have no fear of being troubled by Harry Spafford, but there are bound to be restrictions on her movements.
Also, I will be overseeing the management of her Caribbean estates and its revenues.
So they will not be sold, as she intended?
No. And given their profitability, and I told her so, it would have been madness to do so.
Even if I could not see myself agreeing with her, she had her reasons, nephew.
I dislike the tone of that remark. He snapped. She knew she had overplayed her hand, so it was not a good idea to elaborate on those reasons, which, as Sarah Lovell had said, and truthfully, she was unsure she concurred with. Elizabeth had, many times, both in Jamaica and on the voyage back to England, expressed her distaste for the institution of slavery, having witnessed it on her late husband's estates. This had led her to contemplate their disposal, so as to be no longer personally involved.
The good Lord, Henry responded in a very sententious way, has seen fit to order that some should rule and some should labour. It is not for us mere humans to gainsay a divine dispensation.
Sarah sought to regain lost ground, speaking meekly in order to do so.
I merely pointed out, nephew, that such news will not be welcome, I wonder if, given where we are...
I must act, he interrupted. I have no time to consider Elizabeth's feelings on the matter. Where is Spafford?
I have no idea.
Get him found.
Do you have anything you wish me to say to Elizabeth?
I leave it to you to tell her what you will. The direct look was a dismissal, quickly taken as such. Instructions given to the servants, Sarah Lovell ascended the stairs to stand outside Elizabeth's bedroom. This she had retired to as soon as she was sure it was safe to do so, with Harry Spafford nowhere to be seen. A slow turn of the handle and a push established it was locked, which came as no surprise, unlike the soft knock, which was ignored. Inside, Betsy heard the sound and saw the handle move, so assumed it was her aunt. She had no desire to see her, especially now, while she was composing a letter to be sent to the canonical authorities in Canterbury, detailing her reasons for seeking an annulment. Well aware of the rarity of such things, she was under no illusions as to the difficulties, whereas Henry had seen no one prepared to witness for her, which she would have acknowledged had she known. She was relying on discomfort which would come from any committed Christian swearing and perjuring themselves on a Bible. The problem was to get to that point. The blocked-off postern and the look she'd got from Tanner established she was virtually a prisoner, and one at risk of being ravaged. This could occur if she ever allowed herself to be alone with the spouse who had been forced upon her, with no route to either objection or appeal. A husband had rights in law which he was at liberty to exercise at will. At all costs, she must avoid consummation, which would add another reason to her case, though she had a vague feeling it was a papist issue, and might not be one acknowledged in the Anglican faith. That had her scratching the quill once more on many bits of paper scarred by deletions, until she had a full statement with which she was satisfied. Already written in tiny writing, folded into as small a size as possible as well as hidden away, was a letter to Edward Brazier, explaining what Betsy was sure had occurred. She also begged he forgive her for being so naive in not originally believing him when he told her the truth about her brother. Everything that had happened stemmed from that lack of faith. Harry Spafford was ushered into Tulkington's study, it immediately registering that he'd been at the bottle. Not drunk exactly, but with that swaggering air of alcohol-induced confidence. The grin was too fulsome, the eyes displaying a bent towards masculine humour, which was singularly inappropriate. This left his newly minted brother-in-law off balance, given to him the fellow should be cringing. You and I need to talk, and establish certain facts for which the events of last night did not allow time.
I am yours to command, Henry.
This came with lifted arms and exposed palms, like Christ addressing his flock. The rejoinder was bitingly sharp. I do not think that we have yet progressed to such familiarity. The speed with which the air of easy assurance evaporated was palpable and immediate, driving home a reminder, as if anyone needed, just what a supine creature Harry Spafford was. This pleased Henry, who had required, and now had, a malleable creature to play upon. "Sit," was an abrupt command, obeyed in the manner of a schoolboy anticipating a roasting. "I wish you to know that the ceremony last night allows you no liberties with my sister."
"She threatened to crown me with a poker."
"Be assured, Spafford, displease me and you will wish for such light retribution, and I do not think I have to elaborate." The face lost all blood as the young man's imagination took over. Tulkington guessed he was harking back to the threats relayed to him by John Hawker when he'd held young Spafford in the slaughterhouse. That had included the pork barrel, which he had taken as so believable he'd betrayed his father and revealed the truth of the theft and his future plans. This was to the good. Tulkington required the weakling to be in a state of terror. "Provision will be made for you, so you may take your pleasures, but not in Deal, where you are too well known." There followed a pause to allow that unwelcome news to sink in. "Given your appetites, I suggest any of the Medway naval towns will serve you well."
"I ain't to live here,"
was plaintive and ignored. "The other matter will have to be settled as soon as I can have the paperwork drawn up." A hint of curiosity arose, quickly suppressed in the face of a glare. "You are, by law, now in control of my sister's property, which is substantial." As Henry described the plantations, their extent and income, he could see an intimation of obstinacy, as if Spafford was calculating that he might have the power to bargain. Legally, he had that right, but morally, in any sense of the word, including fibre, he had none. "The stipend you will be allowed takes cognizance of the income from those estates. The actual running of the plantations, as well as their management, you will sign over to me." Emboldened by a possibility of a negotiation, he asked,
"And if what you offer ain't enough, Mr. Tulkington?"
"You will take what you are given and be thankful. If it is not enough, you can spend your time thinking on it, in the Marshalsea with all the others who have found poverty. I'm not your father, and I will not settle your debts."
"Where is my pa?"
Henry sneered. "If I did not know you better, I would wonder if that was concern. As of now, he is safe, and perhaps his continued good health will be contingent on how you behave."
"Can I see him?"
"What purpose would that serve? Until matters are resolved, I insist you stay in the room with which you have been provided. Sleep there, take your meals there, and, for all I care, get stupidly drunk there."
"Sounds like prison,"
he protested, as ever with no real resolve to back up the complaint. "More comfort than you deserve, Spafford. Take from this arrangement what you are gifted. Ask for more, and I might hand you back to Hawker. I think I have nothing more to say, do you?" Spafford came out of the chair slowly, and if he stood, it was not to his full height. He was like a just-whipped hound, and Henry felt a surge of pleasure course through him. He'd been subjected to domination earlier, and enjoyed both it and the subsequent short coupling. Excellent value for his guinea. To be handing out something very similar was equally gratifying. Having eaten a solitary dinner, his aunt having declined to join him, he was back in his study, in the process of writing to his uncle Durley in London to say he was intending to visit. Grady knocked and entered to inform him of the arrival of a covered wagon at the gate to the house, and two fellows with it. "Let them in, Grady, and ask that they wait for me before alighting. That done, send the servants to bed, including yourself." Faced with a look of poorly disguised curiosity, he added, "I am seen to for the night, as will be everything else." He waited some 20 minutes before making his way out through the front door, where he called upon Hawker's men to follow him to the cellar. Dan Spafford was asleep, but the sound of movement brought him round just before a sack was placed over his head. It was a muffled voice that protested as the padlock holding his chains was undone. "You will find out where you are going when you get there, Spafford." Henry could not resist the barb and with it the implication. "Of one thing you can be sure, it will not have pearly gates." A nod, and he was dragged away. Once he'd been loaded, which came with several blows to subdue him, and the cart was back through the gates and crunching its way down the drive, Tulkington went back to his letter, which concluded with the statement that he would be visiting London shortly to finalize certain matters. Chapter 7 The early morning knocking took Joe Lascelles away from his daily chores to the door of Quebec House to be asked to take delivery of a letter in an unmarked cover. It was sealed with plain and unadorned red wax, and to be given into the hand of Captain Edward Brazier. This was espoused by a grubby urchin who was determined not to hand it over unpaid, and, when challenged, not prepared to say from where it had come. That, he hinted with a sly look, could be the subject of an extra coin. Lacking a written address, Joe could not be sure it was genuine. Brazier was absent with the others, so it was for him to decide, and he refused, not least for the quality of the hand doing the delivering.
"Captain ain't here, and I ain't shelling out for what might be just a bit of paper, so you might as well sling your hook."
Expecting protest, he was surprised when the ragamuffin just shrugged, smirked, then gave him a suit-yourself look before wandering off. Rounding the corner by the Navy Yard, the lad met John Hawker, and a questioning look, quickly responded to with a nod and a smile.
"Blackamoor's servant wouldn't take it, Mr. Hawker. Said your captain was away and refused to pay."
Hawker fetched out a small silver coin and handed it over.
"Here, sixpence for your trouble. You know what to say if anyone asks. Good for a few flasks of gin and enough there to treat your mates."
The urchin still had teeth with which to bite the coin, which made Hawker pull something close to a smile to think the lad would suspect it forged.
"Share it? No fear, Mr. Hawker. It'll be kept for me."
"Keep your head clear. I might need you again this day."
As he ran off, the plain seal was broken so the unmarked paper could be removed to show Henry Tulkington's original superscription, which went into Hawker's pocket. As he strode back down towards the Lower Valley Road, he was unaware that what had just happened, including the exchange, had been spotted by Jaleel Trotter, obliged to slip into the recess of a doorway to avoid being seen. It was natural to wonder at what he had just witnessed, and just as natural for Daisy to conclude he would never know. Besides, his mind was set on finding a way to make contact with this Brazier fellow. He'd been told by a crossing sweeper, always a mine of local knowledge, where his man could be found. Right now, all he could do, once Hawker was out of sight, was saunter past the dark blue door he'd been told to look out for. This gave him no indication of how to proceed, for Daisy had a notion that just making himself known would not serve. He was not of the standing to just go calling on a naval captain, even more so with a broken nose and two black eyes. The recollection of Hawker taking the letter from the urchin hinted at a way. So, not being lettered himself, he set out for Basil the Bulger's Molly House along Middle Street, where he was sure he would find someone who was, it being a calling place for all sorts, sailors, rough diamonds, as well as the educated. Brazier had set out for Canterbury just after dawn with Dutchy Holland, Cocky, and Pedler in attendance. The last of that trio of lifelong sailors was deeply unhappy to be astride a horse, even one as tame as the plodding and elderly mare provided by Vincent Flaherty. He was not a joyful man when mounted, made worse by a buffeting and gusting northeast wind, which, he complained, was enough on its own to unseat him.
"Sure, she's short enough," Flaherty had insisted when getting him seated. "Not more'n 16 hands. So if you come off, you won't break anything, bar your pride."
The Irishman had said that to reassure him. The man paying for the hire was less charitable. Brazier had sworn as they left the paddocks at barely a trot, the use of his one-time crewman's last name an indication of his exasperation.
"Damn it, Palmer. Having you along's like escorting a merchant convoy."
"The speed of the most lubberly," added Cocky. "I can recall you were minded to give him a gun, Captain, to hurry them up."
"Good idea, Cocky," was Brazier's response. "Is your pistol primed?"
"Have it a go home, Captain,"
was Pedler's opinion, delivered with a wince. to indicate his pained haunches.
"Joe might need looking after as much as you."
The proposal was ignored, and having passed through Upper Deal, their route brought them within sight of the gates of Cottington Court. Brazier set his mare to a canter and closed the distance, reining in his mare, Bonnie, to sit staring at the elaborate ironwork of the gate. Behind lay the long, straight gravel drive which led to the house, hidden behind trees but for its chimneys, and far enough off to be invisible. He did not need to see it. His thoughts, anxieties, and uncontrollable imaginings were more on what might be happening within the walls. Tanner emerged from the gatehouse to glare at him, tugging at the rope lead and encouraging his mutt to snarl menacingly, which pleased the object. He was sure his presence would be reported to Tulkington, which would send to him a signal that matters were not going to be allowed to rest. He sat there until the others caught up, he and Tanner glowering silently at each other before hauling Bonnie's head round and trotting off up the road.
"Yon Cully looked a cheery soul," called Cocky.
"He works for Tulkington," was all that was required by way of an explanation.
Brazier was set on killing two birds with one stone by journeying through Adisham, where he could call on Admiral Pollock to break what would, for the mounts as well as the riders, be a long journey in a single day. If the old man agreed, he could leave his escorts there and travel on alone, given he could not envisage any threat once he was away from Deal. Leaving the coast behind, the wind eased, yet it still whistled through the treetops to make them sway in a manner that had all four eye them for the danger of a falling branch. The route took them through a string of quiet villages, and, there being no conversation to distract him from his own concerns, Brazier began to wonder what the others were thinking. This, in time, led to thoughts of past events, not least the ritual of sailing a ship of war, endless days in which routine was sovereign, to the very occasional times action was called for. Over the course of a commission, he had got to know every member of his crew, their level of ability as well as their foibles and ailments, even their superstitions. But none came closer to him than those who rowed his barge. That duty had been mostly peaceful and repetitive, calling ashore at the various islands in the West Indies, where he was required to pay his compliments to the local hierarchy. The presence of his ship was there to remind them of the laws he was tasked to uphold, the same ones he was sure they would be trying to evade. The reception ashore was always polite, and a dinner in his honour was seen as mandatory. Any resentments were held in check, even after copious amounts of rum punch, glasses of wine followed by decanters of port, lest it invite this pest of a naval officer to pay too much attention to what was being illegally imported into their speck of terra firma. The times of excitement might be rare, but they stood out more starkly in memory. The sighting from the tops of a strange sail, which, once HMS Diomede had been identified, would close, if friendly and legitimate, to exchange news. Others would run, if not. So then came the excitement of a chase, which, given the sailing ability of American schooners, and the competence of their crews, could last for days, with subterfuge being shown once darkness fell to put him off, which sometimes worked. On other occasions, dawn would find him off their beam with his guns run out, but just as often the chase ended in daylight, and he could then let fly a warning shot across their bows. If that failed to get them to haul their wind, it would become necessary to take to the boats and seek to board. No value came from the sinking of a contraband vessel. Success was calculated in capture. The sale price of the goods it carried added to the value of the hull in which it was stored. The Jonathans rarely gave up without a fight, so boarding would be opposed. It was in those situations where the likes of Cocky, Pedler, but most of all his coxswain, Dutchy, the man in command of his barge, showed their mettle. Diomede's boats had to contend with the Caribbean swell, and so did the deck on which they were trying to gain a foothold. That could be rising and falling 10 feet or more, full of men with weapons determined to drive off these damned Limeys.
I was just thinking, Dutchie, of some of our Caribbean adventures, Brazier said to break the silence.
Tom Holland was riding alongside him, head down and seemingly half asleep, with Cocky and Peddler behind, he muttering an endless string of complaints and woes. The Mount Dutchie Road was the biggest Flaherty possessed, not far off a ploughing beast, which was a good thing, given the size and weight of the man astride him. It was also a very steady platform, which allowed for conversation when Dutchie came to life. The names of vessels Diomede had taken tripped off Dutchie's tongue to be responded to by his one-time captain, as they both recalled the particulars of the ensuing fights. First, musket balls that cracked by their ears, fired by the adversaries. Others coming from their own marines. The combined yelling of insults and threats after Diomede's trio of boats had split up to attack bow, stern, and beam. Then came the clang of their cutlasses as they met those of the fellows seeking to drive them off. It never ended well for the Americans, or the few British prepared to chance the trade. He had a crew just short of 300 men, a high percentage, willing fighters. They sailed sometimes with a contingent as low as a tenth of that number. For them, speed and evasion was the key to success, not manpower.
Not as many captures as there should have been, Captain.
This was said with a bit of a bite, evidence of lasting bitterness.
Too many times we was in the wrong place, were we not?
Brazier's response was guarded.
Don't recall ever having said that, Dutchie.
Didn't have to say it. Such were plain on your chops. And there was all that pacing to and fro and under your breath cursing.
That obvious?
Came with a smile.
To anyone who knows you, Your Honour. Which I have to tell you now was near the old muster.
Claimed to know me, Dutchie.
There weren't much left that were hidden.
He could recall the frustration Dutchie was alluding to, with a barren seascape all around him and not a smuggler in sight, despite what he'd been told in Kingston. Too many times they'd returned from a cruise empty-handed when they'd set out with high hopes and seemingly solid information. He could not tell his old coxswain now how that had become the case. Interception depended a great deal on intelligence which came from spies, usually one-time loyalists in the Carolina ports. If they espoused a hatred of perfidious Albion, there were people who secretly longed for King George to recover the colonies he had so recently lost. Traitors to the majority of their fellow Americans, the information they provided was vital, but it would not serve to tell even Dutchie, whom he trusted implicitly that the man in command of the station, Admiral Hassel, had been dishonest to the point of treachery, both to his sovereign and the service of which he was part, brought on by excessive greed. The period of silence no doubt told Dutchie he was not going to be gifted an explanation, for he changed the drift of the conversation, recalling the taking of the Santa Clara with one recollection advanced with real feeling.
I'm glad we didn't try to board that French bugger. I thank you for that.
It would have been too bloody. They had a full buccaneer crew, maybe as many as 150 men, all of them determined to fight to the death. If they lived, they were down to hang for piracy.
Having caught up with the privateer and its Spanish capture, Brazier had stood off the former and battered the Frenchmen into submission with a level of cannon fire they could not match. Once subdued, he'd maneuvered across their stern, triple-shotted his guns, and fired a salvo through her casements, knowing it would go right along the deck all the way to the very forepeak and kill or maim anyone who stood in its path. He'd never been sure, in retrospect, if he'd carried out so bloody an action through necessity, or as a riposte to the actions of his commanding admiral, and this his French collaborator. Hassel had been dealing with them over many months, passing on the intelligence he should have shared with his own officers. He was deliberately depriving them of prize money, while lining his own purse with a half share of the proceeds, instead of the eighth that would have normally come his way.
"I never asked, Duchy,"
Brazier asked as a way of evading the subject.
"What did you do with your share of the Santa Clara prize money?"
"Got to recall, Captain, it weren't within a mile of what you got. My rating didn't run to a country estate and a coach and four."
"For which I will not say sorry."
'Tis the way of things, sure enough, that those who need the most suck the iron tit."
That was delivered with a wry smile, which also implied it was not necessarily right.
"But there was monies owing for me being at sea when I was paid off, schooling for my nippers, rent and the like. Then there was family, large and all, in need."
The over-the-shoulder shout, posing the same question to the others, got from Cocky the fact that he'd lived like a king for 3 months, and found how easy it was to make friends with a full purse and how quick they disappeared when it was empty.
"Peddler?"
"Same, Captain. Think I married more than one wench in my cups. Right now I'm wishing I'd bought a dog cart or a spare arse."
"Spare head'd suit you better,"
hooted Dutchy. "The one God gave you has never been right. Happen your head was so big there was nought left for decent folk."
The banter, once begun, continued. Their one-time commander aware it was not something in which he could participate, even in the situation in which they now found themselves. It was like that on board ship where his rank cut him off from the easy friendliness of his nature, even with his inferior officers. It came with being in command, which brought on a degree of loneliness. He was the sole occupant of his cabin, a place where everyone deferred to him, even when he invited them to dine. With that in his thoughts, a wave of melancholy swept over him. So it was a blessing they soon entered Adisham. The quartet turned up the lane that led to the home of Admiral Sir Eustace Pollock, to whom Brazier was still and always would be that blasted nuisance of a 13-year-old midshipman known throughout the ship as the Turk. The sobriquet had been earned by his behaviour in fighting any fellow mid, whatever their size, if he felt insulted or abused. Pollock was delighted to see him, given he lived a lonely existence when it came to naval callers. A meal was ordered and cooking before the horses had finished their feed. Pollock would have respect locally and probably a lot of friends, for he was of the nature to be liked and admired. But to a man who spent all his years at sea, the lack of salty visitors hurt as much as the lack of employment. At peace, the Navy had too many officers and too few ships to give them all employment. So dozens of admirals, hundreds of captains, and probably over 1,000 lieutenants were beached from want of the kind of interest a powerful politico or a peer of the realm who would act on their behalf to ensure them a place. None of this was alluded to as they shared the dining board, Dutchy, Peddler, and Cocky eating with the servants in the kitchen. It was all naval gossip and seaboard reminiscence going all the way back to HMS Magnanim, Brazier's first ship. Various reputations were trashed, and a few praised, which was the way of the service, while the politicians who refused to vote enough funds to keep up to strength the wooden walls of England were roundly cursed.
"France won't stir, Brazier," Pollock opined through his chewing. "Rumour has it King Louis has not a brass farthing to his name after fighting for the Americans."
"We cannot, in all conscience, sir, pray for another war."
"No, but we can say that war is when the likes of you and I prosper. Not that you're in need in that department. Happen you could lend the Bourbons a sou or two."
Was there a barb in that? Brazier was unsure. Pollock was not beyond such things, even with someone he claimed to hold in admiration. The thought was dismissed. Having known him for so long, and he being so much older as well as a superior officer, Pollock had earned the right to be tetchy.
"So, what brings you by?"
"Will not a chance to share your company suffice?
came with a quizzical smile.
"Don't bait me, Brazier,"
was a faux irritated response, the good humour badly disguised.
"I've had occasion to put a birch to your backside afore, and I can do it again."
"I'm on my way to Canterbury, to find a legal cove well-versed in canon law."
"One to fire a 42-pounder ball of a suit, no doubt?"
"Very droll, sir."
Once the chortling at his own pun had subsided, the why from the Admiral was inevitable.
"A friend of mine has been forced into an unsuitable marriage. I'm on my way to seek out what can be done to get it set aside."
"A friend?" was posed with a degree of suspicion.
"A very close one, sir."
"I take it to be a lady. It would be damned uncommon for a man to be subject to such a misfortune."
"Of course."
"This lady is merely an acquaintance."
"My plan is to carry on to Canterbury, and if I can, leave my men here with you until tomorrow. And their horses, of course."
That got Brazier a very direct look from a man who knew that such an abrupt change of subject usually emanated from a fellow dodging an uncomfortable truth. It would take no genius, Brazier realized, to fix the nature of the avoidance. He realized, as he was aware of the slight heat in his face, he might as well have just told the truth. It was to be thanked that whatever he had concluded, Pollock chose to respect his reservations.
"That would be good, Brazier, as long as I can set your men to do some late pollarding of some of my trees, getting too old for it myself."
It was odd, given his coming purpose, to be ruminating on a retaliatory pun, on how to fashion one from the connection between Pollock and pollarding. But it would not come, so he was left to lamely reply,
"I'm sure they'd be delighted to assist you, sir."
"As for you and your purpose, it would be best if you stay the night. I will send out to some of my local friends to get a name for you, a lawyer to whom you can take your case. Otherwise you will be obliged to wander Canterbury to find one suitable, and I have to tell you, there are many rogues in the legal profession."
"Thank you, sir."
"Excellent. And over dinner you can tell me of your exploits at Trincomalee. If it was worthy of your step to post-rank, it must have been remarkable. I know from my own experience, Brazier, that raising a man to a captaincy requires some outstanding act of both bravery and skill, one which, to have confirmed, must equally impress their lordships of the Admiralty."
The response was made with a smile, as it had to be, but it was less than enthusiastic. Chapter 8. It annoyed Henry Tulkington that Brazier had been outside his gates and belligerent, even if Tanner assured him no words were exchanged. This was made worse when he met with John Hawker, unusually for the second day in a row to be told his letter had been rejected. He was not, of course, told the truth of the circumstances, how it had been delivered, or that it had not been rejected by Brazier in person, but one of his tars. He was also with someone keen to drive home the nail.
"My guess, Mr. Tulkington, is that in seeing it were from you, he reckoned to know the content."
In the face of a questioning look, Hawker added,
"Well, you weren't likely to wish him good health, was you?"
"I want him out of deal,"
was said with a hint of petulance.
"And if he don't choose to go,
then he must be made to."
Hawker's sense of satisfaction had to be hidden under an air of concern.
"Won't be easy. And I feel bound to add he might not be one to sit quiet and wait for whatever it is you would like to do."
That was acknowledged with a sharp nod, and Hawker drove home another point.
"What if he recruits more of his tars, in numbers, to take us on? There's no shortage with England being at peace."
"Which cannot be allowed.
And I say that not from any sense of dread. Public disorder is bad for business, John, which I have had occasion to point out to you before.
The tone was annoying, like a schoolmaster type admonishing a pupil. Hawker had been in receipt of that from the fellow who'd taught him letters and numbers. At the latter, he'd shown a natural ability, the skill that had originally made him valuable to the Tulkington family. The fellow teaching had found, even barely breached, that John Hawker had fists of which to be wary.
"Can we find out what his plans are?"
"I can ask. Don't say I'll get